This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk. Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
I'm Allie and I live in Southern California. I'm a huge fan of OTI. Their joyful outlook on sobriety is what finally inspired me to quit drinking. I've been a member since day one and I'm rapidly approaching 365 days alcohol-free, which is unreal. I love that Ben and Shaz are not just the podcast hosts. They also openly engage with members during the multiple weekly Zoom meetings and interact on the community member forum. You will not find a more supportive group of people. There's nothing like this in the United States. I'm beyond grateful to be a part of the Sober Rebellion.
You've heard the podcast. Now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to Over the Influence. It is wonderful to have you listening. If you have never, ever joined us before, where have you been? We have been at this for the length of the pandemic, pretty much. I think we've been doing this for 18-ish months now. If you've never heard us before, allow me to please reintroduce ourselves. My name is Sharon Hartley, aka Shaz, Shazar, from the northwest of England. I live in Lancashire. I am 47 still. Three kids, one husband, one dog, and I am approaching, in 2 weeks' time, 3 years, alcohol-free. Life-changing stuff. Unbelievably. Life-changing stuff. Thank you for the little round of applause there from our guest. And Freddie was giving me some sort of finger sign. What was that, Freddie? I'm not sure what that was.
It's a two-finger congratulation.
Thank you for that. I am delighted to be nearly 3 years alcohol free. To say it has changed my life is an understatement. Listen back to all the other episodes and you'll get the gist of where we're at singing about sobriety. It's a really important message that we like to put across. I don't do this on my own. In the future, in New Zealand, is my very glamorous, just out of bed, fresh in his PJs co-host, Freddie. Morning, love.
Morning, love. Sharon Hartley, where have you been all my life? Hello, everybody. My name is Freddie. I'm here in the future in New Zealand. It's an early start, but I'm always happy to make an early start for Over the Influence. And we've got a wonderful guest for you today. I am always so happy in terms of waking up alcohol free almost 1,000 days ago now.
Oh,
I know. And coming up to the 1,000-day mark. And back then, I woke up one morning and I wasn't alcohol free. I definitely wasn't hangover free. And I looked in the mirror and I thought, this is not the way that my life should go. So I changed my behaviors. I stopped drinking after 1,000 failed attempts. And I haven't looked back since. And one of the best things about being alcohol-free is meeting you lovely people and having the opportunity to film and record this amazing podcast with you all. And what started as a crazy idea around the kitchen table is now the world's favourite, the world's fastest growing alcohol-free podcast. And I am so happy to be with you all today.
Oh, Freddie, really well done on the nearly 1,000 days, by the way. That's just... It's ace.
Thank you. I hope it's I make really it. Good. That'd be rubbish, amazing, wouldn't it? If imagine that if it all fell apart.
That'd be the worst alcohol-free podcast. It'd be crap.
It wouldn't be a good advert for the show, would it? Join
no,
the community.
It wouldn't.
Yeah, we're on the. Anyway, I'm sure. Thanks, thanks to Over the Influence, I'm sure I'll make it.
Well, yeah, otherwise you'll have the wrath of me to deal with, let me tell you. Talking of the community, Freddie, a quick hello to our members that are watching this recording. It is wonderful to see you. Some new faces, some older faces, and some shiny alcohol-free faces. It is really lovely to see you. So thank you for joining us. There is no background Ben today. You may notice he's sadly not with us. He is in his little tiny Speedos, in his micro pants, on a beach in Mallorca, being very alcohol free and just, I can picture him now, Freddie.
Oh, I'd be picturing him along all night. With a, believe me, Shaz, I've been in his micro pants.
Enough of that. So we've got no Ben. We are being babysat in the background by Tom's brother, who's just waved at us. Tom's brother, Ben's brother, called Tom. You see, you can tell it's gone to pieces because our boss isn't here, Freddie. So enough about us. This podcast, it works because of the guests that we have on. And we have all sorts of many different guests, many inspirational people. Some are authors, some are influencers, some are amazing tales of recovery and discovery, which is what Sarah Connolly used that term on yesterday's episode. It's not about recovery, it's about discovery. And that stuck in my head. So I want to welcome Sarah Drage to the podcast this evening. Sarah, I just want to start by saying, well, first of all, thank you. And I know that we're going to cover some difficult and some sensitive subjects. So for that reason alone, thank you so much for agreeing to come and chat about your dad, Steve, on the podcast today. It means the world to us. It was a picture I saw on Instagram that caught my eye. And I hope you don't mind me starting with this.
Oh, of course not. Of course.
It was your wedding day. And there's the most beautiful photograph of you sitting there with your dad, and he was just staring at you so proudly. And I thought, I need to read this girl's story. I need to hear from you, and we need to find out about Steve. So would you start, Sarah, please, by just telling us a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself, and we'll start at the beginning.
Yeah, of course. So I'm Sarah Drage. I live in Kent. I have two children, 9 and 6, and I'm married. Have a wonderful husband, very, very idyllic, perfect lifestyle. But with that perfect lifestyle comes the anxieties where I was not used to my life going straight forward. I weren't used to the whole settled and safe and comfortable environment. I am now. Now it's great in a way. But prior to that, no, I wasn't. So my dad was an alcoholic pretty much all my life, apart from my younger years. So it was really my teens that I noticed that. And obviously that comes around with its own issues for myself. So I developed anxiety. I developed health anxiety because that was the way that I could control my own health because I couldn't control his. And then we sadly lost him in 2017. Obviously, I'm going to go into a little bit more detail. I'm trying to cram in as much information as possible.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about, isn't there?
So I have had my own mental illness as a repercussion of what I went through living with an alcoholic parent. And when he died, that was a pivotal moment in my life. It was the hardest moment, but it was also, I would say, a moment that saved me. That's very contradicting because I would give anything to have him back. But his death taught me that life's short. You only live once. And I know this all sounds really cliche, but I knew when he died that I'd sink or swim. And I decided that I didn't want the lifestyle I had had for my children. So I made a point of fighting what we had just been through. And it took a while to learn all of that. So fast forward, I dealt with my anxiety. I dealt with my PTSD, which was pretty savage, actually, after watching my dad die the way he did. And I dealt with bereavement, all of that. And then I realised that actually, we don't talk about all this stuff enough. Like all of that bottling it in, not talking about mental illness or addiction, actually prevented me from getting treatment, but it also, most importantly, prevented my dad from accessing treatment. So from that, I set up my own charitable organisation called Warrior Kind, where we're encouraging conversations, hard conversations like this, to normalise them, so more people feel inspired and empowered to seek that support. And from that, it all happened very quickly. It all snowballed. I was then invited, my application to do a TED talk, which I didn't actually, I was told to apply for that. I never expected in a million years that I would be standing on that red dot. I mean, maybe I've got a bit of imposter syndrome there, but I was fresh out of working a boring job around the school run. So all of a sudden being propelled into this world of just amazing, incredible people. And I'm stood next to them delivering this talk about my dad. And that kind of made me feel really empowered to really talk more, because I don't think there's enough conversation around alcohol addiction. I don't think there's I don't think it gets the recognition it deserves when it's so easily accessible and glamorized amongst society. The repercussions of drinking too much, I just think the stigma attached to it is deadly. So yeah, that was pretty much very nervously told at the beginning.
My little background. Don't be nervous. Don't be nervous. Your mum's friends. Now, Freddie, do you want to say something?
Yes, I would. There's so many different directions that we could go with this, Sarah. I know, obviously, with my story is very similar, and it'd be much more interesting if this was your story than mine. So I won't dwell on it. But yeah, you know, very similar with me. My dad was an alcoholic. I watched him. He was a proud alcoholic, which sounds weird to say. Like he didn't want to change. And maybe this is what we're going to go to as well with your story, that it isn't like you see on TV. It isn't like on Hollywood. He didn't have a battle with alcohol. He was almost on a mission to end his life as quickly as possible through drink, which I think hurts me a lot, because I don't know why he did that, but he did, and he did what he did, and he died very suddenly. And I had that day when I watched him die, and it was very similar for me, because now I have to tell myself that none of this would have been happening if he hadn't died. You know, the podcast, me not drinking, you know, all these things, all these life changes, me being here in New Zealand, none of it would have happened if I'd carried on the path that I'd been on and had just being a drunken idiot. And that's what I have to tell myself. Maybe it isn't true, but I have to tell myself that he had to die for a reason. And that reason was to maybe save me. And so we'll go down all of that. But I'd love to know from the start, from yourself, Sarah, if that's okay for you to share. How did you find it growing up and being in that world with a parent that was a really heavy drinker?
Oh, goodness. So do you know what? If I'm honest, when I was a teenager, so my dad went through something incredibly traumatic. It was a case of life or death situation. As a consequence of that, we ended up moving abroad and then back to Kent. So I'm originally from Yorkshire. I'm originally from West Yorkshire, Leeds, where I grew up. Up until the age of 11. And when I was a child, a young child, I was glued to my dad's hip. I went everywhere with my dad. He was amazing. He was very contemporary. I say contemporary because that was back in the 90s. He was a very open-minded, intelligent, very sensitive man. He ingrained in my sisters and I. I've got two sisters, I'm the eldest. He ingrained independence. He ingrained education and there's so many skills and personality qualities I have within myself now that have been instilled because of him. So as a child, I idolized him, absolutely idolized him. And then going into my teens, I started to notice that my dad's not normal. And I hate to say normal, because what's normal, right? But my dad would act differently. So I'd start picking up on atmospheres, mood changes. His tone of voice would change. He was never aggressive or violent, but he would get quite angry about his past and quite bitter. And I'd know it. I see it in his eyes. His eyes would be glazed. He'd have hiccups. I would see all the signs. I'd notice it. But as a 13-year-old, 13 to 18, I didn't know that that was the alcohol. I didn't understand that. It wasn't until I was, 19, 20, that I thought, I can't be around this anymore. I love you and I don't want to do this, but I can't stay in the house with you anymore like this. So I very reluctantly moved out because I felt like I had to. I couldn't be around that environment. I couldn't be around the ups and downs, the atmospheres. And it made me anxious. So my teens, I loved my dad and I also hated him. And I felt very guilty about saying that, but if I'm going to preach about breaking down stigmas and talking openly, then I need to be really brutally honest and tell you that there were times when I was younger that I would say some horrendous things to my dad. I would tell him he was weak. I would tell him he was self-inflicting his illness. I would say that there's worse off, that all the kind of stuff that I wouldn't dream of saying to anybody now because I didn't understand it. There wasn't the awareness there. So as a young adult was when I would have said my dad's addiction really peaked, and that's when it started getting a lot worse. So living with him, growing up with him was amazing, but it was also really rubbish. Like, it was so many ups and downs. And I think that was quite hard because I loved him so much, really, really loved him. But I also hated him. I hated what he was putting us through. I felt like, do you not love me enough to not do this to yourself? But I understand now that it's far more complex and more complicated than what we understand. But yeah, I would say it was a whirlwind, Freddie. It was a whirlwind of love and hate. And I wanted so badly to control his drinking and to control him and fix him. And I took on that role as the older sibling to try and fix him. But it didn't work, sadly.
I'm just going to jump in there, Sarah. It was something. Oh, I watched your TED talk last night, and it blew me away. It was really amazing and really emotional. But it was just so important what you said. I thought it was amazing. But one thing that struck me, and I can't remember. Forgive me if it was in your TED talk. If it was something that I read, talking about your dad's addiction, and I know it's so important that you talk about shame and the stigma attached to somebody that is an alcoholic. He felt he couldn't get the help needed, didn't want to bother the GP. Now, it's fine. Just tell us a little bit more about that and what that was like, because you're sort of screaming for your dad to get help, and yet he feels like he can't. What an awful situation to be faced with. It's like impossible, isn't it?
Oh, it felt, especially towards the end, I've never ever in my entire life felt frustration like it. I physically cannot describe the frustration. It was like bashing my head against a brick wall. I knew what he was doing. I could see what he was doing. He weren't helping himself. Nobody else seemed to want to help. And it was almost this contradiction of, unless he's going to come to us, we can't do anything to help him. So yeah, I mean, he was a typical stubborn Yorkshireman. He didn't want to ask for help. He didn't want to. And really, if we're breaking it down, it's all about admitting weakness. And I think that's, my dad very much felt like that was a weakness, and that he was burdening the health system because there are worse off than him. I mean, the week before he died, I actually argued with him. I nearly called an ambulance because I was so convinced, and I was right at the time, that he had advanced liver disease. And when I confronted him about it, he shouted at me. He shouted at me. He swore at me, and he became quite defensive. So I thought, you know what? I can't watch you do this to yourself. So I'm going to walk away now. But he made me feel like I was being dramatic, like there was nothing wrong, and that I was just overreacting to something. It turns out I wasn't actually overreacting, and that was end stage liver disease. We just didn't realise it. But when I called somebody to help, they said, unless your dad is going to pick up the phone himself, there's nothing we can do, which to me at that point was incredibly painful and frustrating because he couldn't lift himself up from bed. So there was no way he could have picked up a phone. But I think there was a definite shame and stigma attached to it. There was this definite don't tell anybody, or I can get through this on my own. I don't need help. And like I said, literally the week before he died, he said there are people that actually need help from a doctor that haven't brought it on themselves. And looking back, that's really painful actually to listen to. But yeah, he was so, the stigma, the stereotype, it was so ingrained within him that it was easier for him to stay silent and suffer than it was to actually go and ask for help. And when I thought about it that way, I thought that is so that's bad, isn't it?
Because it's really bad. Yeah,
really, really bad. When we were at the hospital, I really understood why he felt like that. Mm. And I experienced and witnessed the stigma firsthand. We had paramedics shake their heads, people in the waiting room, tots. You could just see the glares and the looks. And he sat there literally 30 hours before he's died in a wheelchair, unaware of his surroundings by that point, because he was too far gone. And we were still getting head shakes, head tuts. We had people tell us, your dad did this to himself. He only had himself to blame, and it was self-inflicted. So at that point, for me, I had so many different emotions. And everyone says when somebody dies, you always feel guilty. It's natural to feel guilty, which I'm not taking that away from any other death at all. But I think with a death from addiction, and I think, Freddie, you'll probably agree with me with this, is that there's a lot of different emotions you have to get through before you can properly grieve. So you've got your anger, you've got your resentment, you've got the bitterness, and then you've got relief. You feel relief because you think, oh, I don't have to worry anymore. And then you feel guilty for feeling relieved. Mm. And then you feel sad, and you feel this physical pain that I felt like I could have stopped this a week ago when I tried calling an ambulance, but you wouldn't get in it. I should have done more. There's all that kind of emotion and guilt and sadness and just it, all kinds of emotions that I had to properly really get a lot of professional therapy to deal with that, because there were so many different emotions there just from one death from addiction and not enough support. There's no way enough support. There's no understanding. There's no awareness around it. And what breaks my heart is the lack of sympathy and empathy people suffering from that illness actually get, or they don't get. And my dad was living proof of that. So it took me a while to get over that. And when I finally did it, and I was finally at peace, and I dealt with the PTSD, I dealt with the trauma, it was then that I sat there and thought, stigma killed my dad. Because had he had the same confidence that, I don't know, and I really want to be careful how I phrase this, because I don't want to offend anybody, but 90% of lung cancers are caused by smoking. But there's a level of empathy and compassion, and rightly so. Any deaf should have that level of compassion and empathy. Nobody should be, or no family member should be told that their dying loved one only had themselves to blame because they drank too much. Because there's so many lifestyle diseases that we can contract from what we eat, what we drink, lack of exercise. So to me, I really started questioning that and really thinking, well, there's a massive hypocrisy amongst society around alcohol addiction. It is the only drug that we glamorize, that we promote, and that we shame people for not drinking. And then we shame people when they drink too much of it. And I couldn't get my head around it. And I started getting really angry, but I was getting angry at society and the government for the way that they're making these people feel. And I'm then having to have these heated debates with people who are telling me that alcoholics should have their NHS rights taken away from them. And I get really passionate, and really, I can go off on a bit of a tangent when I talk about this, but it really, really, yeah, it baffles me.
But this is, you should go off on a tangent and you should be passionate, because this is your dad. He wasn't just an alcoholic. This wasn't just a guy that was sitting in the wheelchair in hospital waiting to die. This was your dad. And what really strikes me about just looking at the things you've shared publicly, Sarah, on social media, it's the photos. And I mentioned this at the beginning. It's the dad giving you away. It's the dad holding you when you were a little girl. And your hashtag is for a man called Steve, because he was a man called Steve. He didn't choose to end his days this way, did he? He would have changed it all if he could. And I think that's what's key, is that it's about your dad being a human, a man called Steve, not a worthless alcoholic, which is it's hideous, and I'm no wonder you're so passionate about it.
It's like they lose their identity and they become this misconception that society has, this stereotype, which is why when I wrote my TED talk, I really made a point about introducing my dad as a person. I made a point about talking about his personality. I made a point about saying how much he laughed, how much he loved his family, how funny he was, because there is this misconception that alcoholics are this just, well, a moral failure. Like, that is what society makes out these people are. And it upsets me, it breaks my heart. It really does. It really just, it makes me so angry, because if my dad didn't have us, who would have helped him? Even at the end, who would have been there? Who would have had that love for him? And there are people out there that are in that situation. There are people out there that are alone, that are battling this alone. And it's things like that that break my heart, because I think the lack of compassion, the lack of empathy, the lack of understanding, it's not the only legal substance that can contribute to disease. And this is what, again, I don't understand it. So, I feel like, again, I've gone off on a rant.
No, not
that's why you're here. You're more than welcome.
and I mean, I was a lot quieter than I usually am, and which is probably a relief for everyone when you were speaking, Sarah, because I was just listening to what you were saying and reflecting on my own dad and everything as well. And you're right. It is such a crazy mix of emotions, and I think you've probably done a better job than me. In fact, I know you've done a better job than me in terms of dealing with a lot of this, because I think I still do have the anger deep down. You know, it's been a few years now since my dad died. I still haven't cried. I haven't shed a tear over him yet, which probably isn't the best thing to do, I'm sure a counsellor would say, but that's a podcast for another day. But I think it is such a big mix of emotions. And I do think there's probably a male aspect to it as well. In fact, in terms of people say, and men of all ages, if they're struggling with drink, with their mental health, there is still that stigma, as you say, of not wanting to ask for help, of not putting your hand up. And it's a very easy get out, saying there's people out there that need more help than me, so I'm going to take a step back. And it is about helping people to understand that there is so much love and support and help around for everybody. And I wanted to ask you, and if it's okay for you to share, to what was the tipping point for you in terms of he sadly died, and then you've obviously been on this journey since then. Was that something that was quite immediate? Was it, you know, was there a light bulb moment at some stage after his death when you thought, you know, this is what I need to do now? And how did all of that come about?
So I'm really honest. There was a few people that I weren't truthful with when they asked me about my dad and the way he died. I felt like, not because I was embarrassed, but because I wanted to protect him from the looks and the look of awkwardness people would give me when I tell them that how he died. There was this kind of like, and then I felt like I had to justify, you know, that it's no different to a death by smoking. It's no different to all kinds of other illnesses brought on by lifestyle choices. So there were some people I told, there were some people that I didn't tell. And it was when I'd gotten over my own issues with anxiety, PTSD, and I'd accepted and really properly understood what he was going through. And it was a family friend, actually, who's a doctor, and he's got a great interest in alcohol addiction. And he sat me down and he explained that your dad couldn't help this. He believes it's a disease. I know that's very touchy ground. So I believe it's a disease. I believe it alters your brain chemistry. I know some people don't, but he sat me down and he really explained that. And do you know what? When I realized, and the pivotal moment and the tipping point for me brought a lot of guilt, because when I suddenly realized that he couldn't help it, he wasn't choosing alcohol over me. He had no choice. I know there's different types of alcohol addiction. My dad was sadly dependent, so he had no choice. He had to carry on drinking. He couldn't just stop, otherwise he'd die from withdrawal. I didn't understand that. I would pour his alcohol down the sink thinking I was helping him. It wasn't until he died and somebody actually sat down with me and explained all of this, And then I got angry because I didn't know it then. And I would get angry at myself. And I, the guilt was just all consumed. Sorry. The guilt was just insane because he had a very serious illness that wasn't taken seriously when he was alive. And I didn't realize it until it was too, well, it was too late by the time I realized it. So once I got over the anger, I then thought, there's no point in getting angry at everybody because it's not their fault. It's no different to how I used to think. I used to think like that. It's all about education and awareness and talking about this and having these open, honest conversations like I do. Some people tell me I share too much. Some people say you're trying to make something off the back of your dad's death. I'm not. I don't want to do this, if I'm really honest. Sometimes I feel that I'm spending time that I could be spending with my girls, but I feel like I need to do this. I feel like this is so important because there's not enough people talking about it. There's not enough awareness and education out there. And if it can save somebody, then my dad's death had purpose. It had some kind of meaning. And as selfish as that sounds, I get therapy out of that and it helps me. Just listening to how my dad's story is helping other people, I don't know, it just feels like, I don't know, when he died, all this shaking their heads and telling me that he only had himself to blame. It's like all of a sudden people are talking about a man called Steve. He's not an alcoholic, pisshead, drunk, self-inflicted, weak person. He's a man, and he's a man called Steve, and he's a man who had a family, and he's a man who had a family who loved him unconditionally. He loved us. And that's what is important that we do, is that we create awareness, we talk about it, we educate people so that millions, and literally it is millions of other people that are physically dependent or that are struggling with alcohol, feel empowered to get the support that they deserve. Because like I said, it's a legal, accessible substance. It's incredibly addictive. Our brains, our bodies react to it all differently. You can't help it if you're going to get addicted to that. I mean, you walk into Tesco's or any other supermarket, you'll see that cigarettes are covered behind a screen, whereas alcohol is in your face. It's everywhere you go. I couldn't even pick up a birthday card without having a bottle of Prosecco on it or a bottle of beer or telling you you need to have a drink to have a good time. And then it's stuff like that that I think about and think, you can't penalise somebody who's addicted to alcohol when you've constantly had it in their face. Like, society glamorises it. Where am I going with this? See, I've gone off on a tangent again.
You keep going on your tangent. Keep going.
It's the passion. It comes out. But it does. And my pivotal moment was three years after my dad died. I was, well, even maybe less than that, maybe 2.5 years. And I finally got over the anger and finally understood, actually, there needs to be more done. There needs to be more awareness. There needs to be more people talking about this. And I'm a very open person. I am quite happy. I mean, I can't preach it and not be open myself. So, and I think I know my dad, and I know that he was an incredibly sensitive man who would help anyone. My dad would always put others first before himself. And a massive part of me believes that it was that sensitivity that led him to drink, because he didn't have that tough personality to deal with what he'd gone through. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with being sensitive. In fact, I said in his eulogy that having a soft heart in a cruel world is actually a courage. It's not a weakness, it's a courage. And the fact that he had to drown that out with alcohol, this world was just too harsh for him to live in. So, yeah, I think that definitely, but since learning more about what it causes and the dangers of alcohol addiction and the lack of understanding is what really spurred me on for my dad, really.
Hi, we're Sound Rebel and we produce this podcast.
We make loads of entertainment shows like this one, but we also make informative and educational podcasts for businesses. We can help with the whole production process, from idea development through to podcast distribution to all the major podcast apps like Apple Podcasts, Spotify and Google Podcasts.
Email hello@soundrebel.co.uk now and we'll get back to you as soon as we can.
Right, back to the episode.
Sarah, thank you so much for sharing so honestly and so passionately. It's incredible, really. It's a really painful story, really painful. But obviously what you're doing now, there's got to be a positive, you know.
Yeah.
Your voice is being heard and you will make change. I think my question is, what would have helped your dad? And what will help the next person, the next man called Steve, the next woman, the next dad, the next mum that finds himself in this position? How do we get rid of the stigma? Where does it start? It's like a massive question. I don't even know if you can answer that, actually.
I think it all comes down to open, honest conversations. I think it's really that simple. I think it's that society is ingrained in us that we shouldn't air our dirty laundry or talk about anything bad that's happening. But we're living in a world where people are sharing all the good stuff. You quite happily snap pictures of your nice holiday, you'll upload it to social media, you'll share pictures of your beautiful home, your nice car. That's all right. But the moment you start getting too personal, you're almost scrutinized for it. And it's something that's brushed under the carpet. We shouldn't tell anybody. I think it's there that we need to change. I think if we're willing to share the good, then we need to be honest about the bad. And once we can get past that point that asking for help isn't a weakness, saying to somebody, I have a problem, isn't a weakness, but it's getting to that point. And it's ironing out that misconception that society has. It's educating, it's more awareness, it's more understanding from society that these things happen and there's usually a deeper meaning. There's usually a deep rooted cause and it's usually trauma. I said at the beginning that my dad had gone through a lot of trauma and his way of handling that was to drown it out with alcohol, because quite ironically back then talking about his mental health was also a weakness. So it was like a vicious circle. Yeah. For my poor dad, he had anxiety, he had depression, he had PTSD, couldn't deal with that or open up about it because that was a weakness. So instead he drank, which created another problem. So I think it's breaking down that stigma. Now, I'm not saying that's going to work for everybody, because I understand that it takes a great amount of willpower and strength to really commit to sobriety and really, really commit to that road of recovery and access the support that you can get. But I think for a man called Steve and for everybody else who's in that situation, I think the key point for a lot of people, and a lot of people have come forward to me to say to me that, yeah, do you know what? The stigma stopped me from getting help because I didn't want to tell my family. I didn't want to go to my doctor and have it on my records. I didn't want my work to find out. I think it's those kinds of conversations. I mean, not wanting somebody's employer to find out because they're scared of being sacked is absolutely ridiculous, because the employer will allow smoking breaks. That's an addiction. It's an addiction to nicotine. You're smoking. It's no different, in my opinion. Whereas if your employer finds out you're addicted to alcohol, some don't. It's that level of hypocrisy that needs to be eradicated, I believe. So I think really it's these open, honest conversations and talking about it, just being open-minded and understanding and compassionate and not thinking so narrow, thinking, okay, this person's drinking. Why is this person drinking? Why are they turning to drink? What's going on in their life that is so difficult to deal with that they need to drown out the noise with the euphoric side effects of alcohol? So I think it's those honest conversations. And I know not everybody's there yet. And I have my fair share of scrutiny from some people, but it needs to be done.
How does that make you feel, Sarah?
Angry. So I'm not going to lie. People say, oh, don't listen, don't let them bother you, don't let them grind
you down.
It's
not that easy, though, is it?
No. Sometimes when I'm, depending on what mood I'm in, sometimes I might think, no, they're just lucky they don't understand. They've not obviously been through anything like this. They don't understand it because they've not been forced to understand it. So it's not their fault. And then on the flip side of that, I think it's you're the reason people like my dad don't get the help, because you're instilling that stigma. By encouraging people to not talk, you're basically saying that it's something that you should be ashamed about and not have people know about. And that's deadly. That, to me, that's dangerous. That's a dangerous attitude to have. So yeah, I have I'm trying to navigate that so I so I could get a little bit, because it's not good for me when, especially when I get that level of cynicism and it's not nice, but it is what it is.
I think you're so right, Sarah, and I think first to go back to something you said about it, that those wider society attitudes and the attitudes in work is absolutely correct. And I've started posting more about Over the Influence on places like LinkedIn from, the very outwardly corporate, very look at my promotion LinkedIn. And I felt a bit nervous about that because I knew to be talking about Over the Influence, I've got to be open and honest and talk about my own story with alcohol. And I'm now posting this not only on Facebook, but like on LinkedIn to all of my bosses, all of my HR people. And a lot of people are there saying, very brave, very open, very honest. And I'm like, great. But I remember 10 years ago, it was made very clear to me, if I wasn't in the bar doing tequilas at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday night, that I was going to miss out on the next promotion, or I was going to, my career would suffer, or things like this. So then you wake up with the anxiety of the hangover, and let's face it, I would have done something stupid. And then like, oh, what's my boss going to think? And this, I don't want to lose my job, but I don't want to do this and that. And it's some kind of ingrained in society that more employers and more people are saying, yes, we know alcohol's bad. And you say, right, do something about it, take some action, make a change. And then, oh, no, can't do that. And it does literally cost lives, as you say. And it's so bloody frustrating that there are people like yourself out there trying to make these changes. And it does feel like we're all screaming in the wind sometimes. But I do believe that thanks to people such as yourself and Warrior Kind, that we are starting to make a difference as well. And I was going to ask, if I may, with Warrior Kind, for anyone that isn't aware of it, what do you do? What changes are you trying to get made, and how are you supporting people?
So at the moment, I've kind of got two things going on. So Warrior Kind is all around mental health, which I think amalgamates in addiction. I think a root cause of addiction is mental illness, mental health. So we're a charitable organisation, and what we're doing is we're encouraging fundraising, we're encouraging healthy conversations. We invite people onto camera to talk about their experiences, and we put it out there publicly to showcase that with their permission. The whole point in that is that we're creating a dialogue, we're empowering people, we're inspiring people to know that they're not alone. With our fundraising, we are funding people through treatment, but we're funding them through the right treatment. So somebody comes to us and they've got PTSD, but they're in the middle. They're right in the middle with the NHS. So they're not quite urgent enough to get urgent treatment, which on some cases is absolutely mind-boggling, which I know the NHS is stretched at the moment. But they don't have the money to go private and pay £100 a session for a treatment called EMDR therapy, for instance, which is 90% effective for trauma. So what we have two models. We have our business model, which is run as a community interest company, and we have our charity model. So what I'm trying to do is make sure that any funds that come into our charity side do not get spent on running costs of the charity or paying wages. They go directly to our warriors, and we fund that treatment. We go through them, we'll signpost them, we'll triage them to the right kind of treatment. And the other thing that I'm doing on the side from this at the moment is some of you may be aware of a influencer called Sober Dave.
Yeah.
Is absolute. Dave is brilliant. He's.
Yeah, we follow him. We've seen loads of his stuff. He's fantastic.
He's, do you know what? He's really, we met through my TED talk. I asked him to share it. I said to him, listen, you don't have to tag me. I'm not interested in a personal brand. I just want you to share my TED talk to your followers because I think it can help them. Well, he really connected with my dad. He connected with me. It's almost kind of like a fatherly daughter kind of bond. He feels very strongly that he could have been in my dad's situation. And I listening to me was like listening to his own son. So we have got some amazing things that we've lined up. For instance, going into schools, talking about, we've got a booking in October to go and speak to a secondary school about the dangers of alcohol, alcoholism itself, and to talk about two different perspectives. So we've got his perspective as the recovering alcoholic, myself as the daughter of an alcoholic or of a loved one. So there's so many things that we've got in the pipeline there in terms of events, podcasts, talks. And we're kind of collaborating at the moment just to really test the waters and really push two different perspectives. He's got a great following, and it's not about the following at all. But what it does mean having a large following is that we can reach more people, spread more awareness, raise more awareness, educate more people. And he's got some great links of Alcohol Change UK, NACOA. So it's great to partner with those charities, to support those charities and really drive that message, because ultimately at the moment our biggest thing is to break down that stigma. It's to break down the stigma so more people don't feel ashamed to talk about it. Some even people like myself, because it's a family illness. It doesn't just affect the person drinking, it affects their entire family. As you're aware, Freddie, like it the repercussions it has on us, and we're often the ones overlooked. But for me, I said at the beginning, anxiety, OCD, PTSD, all of that was a repercussion of living and growing up with an alcoholic parent. So it has its effects. So I think it's really important that we drive that message, we educate, and we encourage people to get support that they're entitled to and support that they deserve. Because quite honestly, a lot of these people believe they don't deserve that. And I think that is just absolutely, it breaks my heart. It really does. It's really horrible that that's happening. And we're 21st century. I don't understand it. So, yeah.
Please don't apologise.
Not at all. I was going to say that. And I think the work that you're doing, and we know Sober Dave, obviously, we're hopefully going to get him on the podcast soon. And yeah, I think that the work that all of you are doing is absolutely incredible, and it's so needed. There's so much, I think, on the surface level of from someone from the outside, they'll just say, oh, you guys just stop drinking. It's fine. Just do that. But then the complexity and the stigma and the mental health links and all of those things, I think all of us here could recognize in some way or another. And I think we've probably all got similarities, but I'm sure that all of us have got different journeys, different paths, different skeletons in our closets and everything else. And that just highlights just how complex this beast can be. But I think with all of us coming together with the wonderful work that you're doing, we really can change the world. And I know I bang on and I joke about things like the Sober Rebellion and stuff like that, but this is really what I mean and what I talk about, a movement of people that can support each other, that can take away the stigma. And I totally agree with what you say, by the way, around it doesn't matter who you follow. And I think sometimes with like the sober community, it's, oh, are you following that person? Or is it Sober Dave? Or is it Andy Ramage? Or is it this other people? It doesn't matter who you follow. It doesn't matter who you get the message from. It isn't about getting a blue tick or something like that on Instagram. It's about changing lives and saving lives. And the fact that you're doing that, I think, is so powerful and so wonderful. And thank you.
No, thank you. Honestly, thanks for having me on here and letting me waffle away.
Oh, crikey. We love a waffler, Sarah. We love a waffler. You're welcome anytime, honestly. Thank you so much.
We've got a few questions as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Freddie, we've got about 5 minutes left, so I very quickly wanted to mention Sarah. I'm not going to use any names because this is this isn't our premium podcast, which is hidden in the vaults. This is our public podcast, so I'm going to avoid using names. One of our community members has just posted in the chat box, this person is supporting a family member who is living with liver disease, continues to drink hard, and today, this is really sad, today is heading to a hospice to live out his final few days. I am so sorry to read this. This is so it is so sad. So our community member is just asking how best she can support this person during this time. I'm really sorry to read that.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. I can't. Well, I can imagine it. It's horrendous. I'm going to share with you some advice that a great family friend of ours shared with us I've mentioned him earlier on. He's a GP, so he was fully aware of what was happening to my dad when we were reading back the results. And he said, hold them close, like, tell them you love them, say everything you need to say, and just hold them tight. Tell them that you know that it wasn't their fault and that they couldn't help it, because again, it's that stigma. They're going to feel this great, like, and I knew I could see it in my dad's face towards the end. He knew what he'd done, and the fear in his face. And everything I got to say to my dad, he was on life support machine at the time, so I only hope that he heard me. But there's not much else, and I'm really sorry that you're going through this. I genuinely am. I really genuinely feel your pain. But I think holding them close, telling them you love them, telling them you know that it wasn't their fault and that you're there for them, I think that at this point it's crucial that they know they're loved and they know that it weren't their fault. And I think that is the main thing. It's taking that blame away. And yeah, I'm really sorry. I really am so sorry.
Not at all. I was going to say also, what would you say around supporting the family members? Let's say the person that's in the hospice, and they've got a son, for example. How can that person, or how can the family members get support?
So again, what I found most comforting, although it did make me feel guilty, I found it comforting when I was explained about the stigma. Breaking down those stigmas and letting these people understand it more. And I think whatever you've learned around the awareness and the education around alcohol addiction is sharing that with them. So for instance, I've known people that got really angry and bitter with the person who had died, and they couldn't face that person or they couldn't talk about it. But I think taking away that bitterness and that anger from somebody and instead educating them and letting them know that this was an illness, this was no different to a lung cancer caused by smoking, no different to a disease caused by what we've been eating. It's an illness and they couldn't help it. There isn't, and I think just gifting them all that awareness of that and breaking down those stigmas might make it easier for the family to accept and treat it like any other illness that it is. So I think when I knew that, although it hurt me because I didn't know it at the time, it made me understand it more. So it made me feel less bitter and resentful towards my dad. I hope that makes sense.
No, it does, definitely. And I think it's crazy rollercoaster of emotions, isn't it? With the bitterness and the resentment, but also the fact that you miss them and you love them and you wish it was different. And it's all... I think alcohol's got a lot to answer for, and some of our other members in the comments here have said, you know, you can buy it at a service station and or you know like the petrol station or a gas station, but it's illegal to drink and drive, which is crazy. And another member says, being more open with alcohol is a problem. We as a society, we normalize drinking until we black out. We normalize drinking until we're sick, and we think that's a good time, and we celebrate this when we're younger, but when does it become a problem? And it's so difficult, isn't it, trying to work out where that line is and when other people are crossing it and when we're crossing it ourselves.
Absolutely. It's what they've just said about it being normalized amongst society. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And it's that, it literally is that, isn't it? You can't win. Either way, you can't win.
Even now, you know, even with the podcast where it is and the amazing journey that we've all been on and the community and everything else, I had someone comment on my Facebook post the other week saying something like, oh, if no, you're not drinking, there's more alcohol for the rest of us to drink. And like, honestly, I was like, really? Like, you know, I'm almost 40 now. Like, my mates are almost 40. It's like, maybe when you're 19 or 20 or something, you could do that. But like, oh, like, really? Like, with the 18 months everyone's gone through, and you think you're winning sometimes, and you think maybe, just maybe, we're helping one more person to talk about alcohol and mental health, and you're helping to change lives and help people to drink differently. There's someone's like, oh, does that mean you don't drink? Oh man, like,
change the record.
But that's what society's like.
if I go out and I don't drink, then I'm assumed pregnant.
Brilliant.
I don't get that too much, funnily enough. Like, I'm sure I've had most of everything.
Do you know what I do now? So, and I know we're running out of time. I'm really sorry, but it's gotten to a point now where I am very open. If somebody sober shames me, then, and they'll say, oh, what, you being boring, or you pregnant, or you what, the designated driver, I just look at them blank in the face and I say, I don't drink because it killed my dad. And they look and they go, and I go, yeah, don't sober shame.
What else can you say? I mean, that Sarah is just, well, good on you for having the balls to do that. And I hope you say that to every single person that sober shames you from this point forward. Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. We do need to wrap up. We have been chatting for an hour. I do believe we could possibly chat for another three, Sarah, because it's so important. So thank you so much. Everybody has really enjoyed that, our community members. I can see the words amazing, inspirational, brave. Sarah, you are amazing. So the feeling amongst our community is just unreal. So thank you so much. From myself and Freddie, and I know if Ben was here, he'd have really, really enjoyed chatting to you. So on behalf of the three of us, and of course Ben's brother, our babysitter Tom, who is in the background doing all the sort of tech bits, a massive, massive thank you. Sarah, your story is inspirational. Your dad sounded like a wonderful fella, and yeah, I'm sure he would be so incredibly proud of what you're doing now. So, you know, you've got to take that, haven't you?
Thank you.
He must be, he'd be super proud, and it's just wonderful. You've left me a bit speechless, actually. It's not often I'm speechless. If people want to find out more about you and Warrior Kind and the message you want to get out and watch your TED Talk, where can people find you, Sarah?
So on my Instagram account, I'm probably the most active on Instagram. And I love being around the sober community. I think it's like a big family.
Isn't it the best place?
Yeah, everyone's just so welcoming and so lovely. So I'm Sarah_Drage, Drage. And there's links in my bio to Warrior Kind and to my TED Talk. But yeah, I mean, I say to everyone, I don't do this for a following at all. Like, a lot of me, I sometimes don't know how to take the lovely comments that people give me, because I don't feel like this is entirely my story. This is my dad's. So yeah, I think thank you. Thanks for bringing me on here, and thanks for everybody. Thank you, everybody, for your support and for being so lovely and kind. But thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. It's been a rollercoaster of emotions. I know, you know, personally as well, it certainly makes you think. But I think what you have done is absolutely make him proud, and show that something positive and pure and life-changing can come out of such a terrible situation. And
absolutely,
I think where I probably finish is thinking about the future as well. And you talked at the start of this about your life growing up with your dad and everything that came out of it when he was drinking. And I just think now of the example that you're setting to your children that you mentioned at the start. And this isn't about, or isn't just about a dad and his daughter. It's a dad and his daughter and his grandchildren. And I think the way you're going to positively impact those kids' lives, and they're going to look up to their mum and see what an amazing, life-changing job that you're doing. And I think that is the main positive things to come out for it. And that's what I have to tell myself as well, that it was the past, and there were great times and there were bad times in the past, but we can all now control the future, and we can set a great example to our children, or try to, in my case. Not sure how good at that I am, but you can set a great example to your children. Yeah. and change the world, and the next generation, I'm sure, will be a little bunch of alcohol-free rebels, which is going to be amazing to see.
Fingers crossed. thank you
so much.
Thanks.
Discover more shows on the Sound Rebel Network.
Like Men Lose Weight.
This is Men Lose Weight,
a podcast about four blokes who partied hard through their 20s together, and now they think, maybe we should try and lose a bit of weight in their 30s together.
Be honest now, lads. Have you ever been in the middle of a personal trainer session and feigned an injury?
Guys, so I moved from Birmingham to Nottingham 2 years ago, right? Turns out I've been paying for a gym for 2 years that I live over 100 miles away from.
I guarantee at one point or another, he said, nothing tastes as good as skinny feels.
Obviously didn't try that pizza. Did you try that pizza that came out this year? The one good thing about 2020 where it's like KFC and pizza combined.
I have lost £3 this week.
Just so you know the numbers, I've also lost £3 this week.
Whoa!
I'm down to 17 stone 4.
I have also lost £3 this week.
What? You are joking me.
I am £1 down this week.
It's all
well
good.
Done, mate.
We've all lost, progress. which is definitely better than last week, boys. Well done.
A lot better than last week.
£10 in a week, boys.
Well, that's like a bait. That's more than my baby weighed when he was born. So we've lost that collectively in a week. So, I mean, if you want to look at that, that's pretty decent, isn't it?
Men Lose Weight from Sound Rebel. Listen now on your chosen podcast app.